I'm not sure if I should be saying good morning, good afternoon, or good night, since you could be listening to this podcast at any time of the day. And if it is 3 o'clock in the morning and you are listening with the expectation that this will put you to sleep, that's okay. Just don't tell me. I am Richard Olson, and this is a lay-led service from the First Universalist Unitarian Church of Wausau, Wisconsin. It is Sunday, July 5th. Our services over the next few weeks will likely be different than our usual Sunday services, and mostly lay-led. I have been a member of this church for nearly 30 years, and I welcome you to this worship service with these words. Think of the word worship to mean something other than adoring somebody, putting them on a pedestal. Think of it as meaning to shape something into something of more worth and not the monetary kind. As we come together in this moment and in body and spirit and soul, let's ponder our worth, our personal worthiness, our worthiness as a congregation, and our worthiness in a larger community. And let us remember that someone in our ranks is struggling today and may even wonder if this effort is even worth the while. And may that person know that someone in our ranks is at peace today, someone who would like to tell them, yes, it's worth the while. I will now light our chalice, and the words that I'd like you to recite are in the order of service, and I'd like to have you recite them loud enough for me to hear. As is our tradition, we will now sing Spirit of Life. The recording you will hear is the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley, California, singing the song in Spanish. You will find the words to the song in your order of service in both Spanish and English. It is not a direct translation word for word. In fact, the first line in Spanish is Fuente de Amor and translates as either Fountain of Love or Source of Love. So try to sing along in Spanish, and I promise not to correct you. Now, please join me in a moment of silent meditation. I have two readings this morning, an ancient reading and a more contemporary one. The ancient reading comes from Matthew 25, 35 to 40. Matthew portrays a Jesus who is the voice of compassion for others. Unfortunately, such a compassionate voice has been muted by the dissonance of our times. Here's the verse. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? The king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for the one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. The modern reading is from Toni Morrison, and when she received her Nobel Peace Prize in Literature for 1993, the theme of that of her acceptance speech was the power of words. Words, she said, have the capacity to liberate, empower, imagine, and heal. She adds that when they are cruelly employed, quote, render the suffering of millions mute. Referring to what she called, quote, infantile heads of state, unquote, who speak only to, quote, to those who obey or in order to force obedience, she says oppressive language does more than represent violence. It is violence. Writing in the New Yorker magazine after the 2016 election, she wrote, quoting again, "So scary are the consequences of a collapse of white privilege that many Americans have flocked to a political platform that supports and translates violence against the defenseless as strength. These people are not so much angry as terrified with the kind of terror that makes knees tremble." There have been several words to describe it. For some, it is la bestia, the beast, for it is big, it is strong, and it is mean, as is the nature of a beast. Some have used the words el tren de los desconocidos, the train of the unknowns. Others have used these words, el tren de los muertos, or train of the dead. To catch this train, there has never been a line for tickets, a waiting room, or even a depot for that matter. Just a stark railroad yard in southern Mexico where passengers stand around in the early morning hours considering their options. Chance it here and now? Walk along the tracks for a later opportunity? Or just go home? They consider the risks. The risk of getting separated from their group, the risk of losing an arm or a leg, the risk of being mugged, assaulted, or raped, and of course, the risk of death. But not so long ago, some saw another option. They would walk. So they did. Strangers among strangers, in the safety of numbers. Some got lucky and caught a ride from sympathetic drivers. Some were offered food and water along the way. Many, but not all, managed to get to the U.S. border after traveling between 1,500 miles if they headed for Texas and 2,500 miles if they went on to California. But getting to the border and crossing it are two different endeavors. One of the promises candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador made during his bid for presidency during the 2018 Mexican elections was that migrants would be treated with respect and compassion. His was la voz del pueblo, the voice of the people, and he won the election. But things changed fast in the hot-headed, or should I say empty-headed, politics of the day. Threatened by that imperial voice that often growls the threat of economic sanctions, he was pressured to harden his heart, or at least appear to. We learned in our science classes that all living organisms have two basic functions, survival and procreation. This is achieved in many ways, migration being one of them. Migration is natural to our world. Gazelles and zebras migrate in circles on the African Serengeti. Monarch butterflies migrate from the United States and Canada some 3,000 miles to Mexico, but it takes four generations of them to make the full cycle. Blue whales, the largest living animal in the world, migrate from cold waters to warmer waters, but their pattern of migration is still a mystery. Plants migrate, often due to climate change and often aided by the wind. Disease migrates. Birds do it. Bees do it. Even educated fleas do it. Of course, sorry, I got carried away. And of course, we human beings do it too. In our social studies classes, we learned that the first humans to occupy what has become known as the Americas crossed a land bridge that connected two continents and then migrated south. As students, we settled for that brief explanation while at the same time fantasizing about aliens from outer space. So, with those very brief lessons in social studies and science behind me, let's move on to history, geography, and current affairs. Hey, once a teacher, always a teacher. Early in our history as a nation, concerns over immigration and what it entails to be a citizen led to the Naturalization Act of 1790. It allowed any free white person of, quote, good character, who had resided in the United States for a minimum of 2 years to apply for citizenship. This seems like a very liberal policy, but in the context of a nation hoping to populate itself, it makes sense. As for the part about, quote, good character, we might consider that today as a reasonable expectation of our elected officials. Following our Civil War, some states began to enact immigration laws of their own. But in 1875, the Supreme Court ruled that immigration is the responsibility of the federal government. Since that time, many laws have been passed, often excluding the Chinese. You see, they just don't look like us. One policy implemented in 1954 was officially called Operation Wetback. The most recent wave of human migration into the United States from the South came from Central America. Many first entered Mexico at its border with Guatemala. That border is a porous one with rivers, mountains, and dense forests. For many years, it has been crossed in both directions by smugglers and, until recently, had little or no border control for migrants heading north. The U.S.-Mexico border is much longer and cuts through miles of the Sonoran Desert. More than just a physical line, it marks the point where two quite different economies and cultures meet. Like most borders, the U.S.-Mexico border is a fluid one. Rivers change course, treaties are signed and ignored, and land is bought, sold, and appropriated. But borders will always be crossed, sometimes over welcome mats, other times not. So we build barriers, from the mythical walls of Jericho to the Great Wall of China to the Berlin Wall. We human beings have devised ways to keep people both in and out. Some barriers are the stuff of sticks and stones. They cost money, they often require little maintenance, and are clearly visible. Yet other barriers are invisible. We cannot touch them. They cost little money, but they are constantly maintained, and they are more difficult to tear down. Sometimes we cross these barriers unintentionally. Other time, with resolve and malice. These are the barriers of hurtful words and actions. They are constructed upon the foundation of fear, hatred, racism, and nativism. They are cemented together with slogans, cultural tropes, stereotypes, and nativist rhetoric. And when the voices of those who build those barriers echo throughout our land, they are easily punctuated with sticks and stones, baseball bats, and assault weapons. A few years ago, a tweet went out containing only this quote, "We build too many walls and not enough bridges." The man who passed along that quote is now our president. We build too many walls and not enough bridges. Indeed. While President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, announced a new approach to our policies toward Latin America. He called it the Good Neighbor Policy, and it essentially meant, if you want good neighbors, you have to be a good neighbor. But policies change with the times, and the Cold War, with the hyped-up threat of godless communism, led to U.S. policies in Latin America that were, shall we say, not so neighborly. To say that failed U.S. policy in Central America have had little or no effect on the current situation is not true. But to say that those failed policies are the sole cause is equally untrue. It is an area beset by natural disasters, volcanoes, earthquakes, and mudslides. It has been exploited by foreign powers since the arrival of the Europeans. It has been oppressed by religious authorities for almost as long. Some of its traditional major exports, such as bananas and coffee, are now subject to more global competition. Gangs control many aspects of daily life, and corruption permeates at every level. But the biggest threat to our nation right now does not come from our neighbors to the south, nor does it come from the strangers among us. It comes from the neighbors across the street, on the other side of the fence, on the next block. It comes from that neighbor that sends a threat to Minnesota Representative Omar, in which she is told she won't die alone when a very capable person with a very big gun targets her at the Minnesota State Fair. It comes from the neighborhood teenagers who, armed with spray cans, paint slurs on the outside wall of their high school, the N-word, the F-word, slurs against Jews. One of the perps said he had never heard of the Holocaust. His father backed him up in court, saying that as a father, it has slipped his mind to talk to his son about that minor event in history, as if his son had never heard of it anywhere else. It comes from our neighbors who pressure school districts to either leave out or downplay historical events such as the Holocaust, the history of slavery, and the internment of Japanese Americans. It comes from vigilantes who murder an innocent jogger and the network of good old boy white privilege that protects them. They say that figures don't lie. I say, well, maybe not, but figurers do lie. Hence, so many conflicting statistics and assertions about migration in the United States. Most reliable sources report that there are somewhere between 11 to 12 million migrants who are here illegally. Yet others claim about around 30 million. They dismiss them as, quote, illegals, and they believe they all snuck in, they displace American workers, and they commit violent crimes. What most people do not know, or prefer not to know or believe, is that, according to Border Patrol and Homeland Security, most illegal migrants enter our country legally with visas and then just stay on. Yet our attention is directed to our southern border. That makes for a convenient focal point to rally nativists and lazy people who blame migrants for their unemployment. Last summer, while strolling the grounds of Chalkfest in downtown Wausau, I engaged in a conversation with a Church of the Nazarene missionary and his female companion. At one point, the issue of migration came up. She looked me in the eye and said, quote, "They are coming here to kill us." Well, I did not let that go by, reminding her the scriptures she reads, including those about Jesus, you know, that Jesus, the Nazarene, was a voice for a more welcoming approach. We need to understand that many of the most recent migrants, these refugees, are coming to the United States not to shop on Rodeo Drive, to destroy American culture, or kill us. I mean, let's face it, we're the ones with the guns. For the most part, most of our southern neighbors who want to migrate to the United States are doing so to escape extreme poverty, violence, and corruption. Many are seeking asylum, which is a legal process. They want to enter legally. They understand that the American dream is not a gift and they are willing to start at the bottom in order to achieve it. Of course, I'm talking about that old-fashioned, traditional American dream, and not the American dream of white nationalism. And as they pursue their American dream, in the same way our ancestors did, they are satisfied to live in homes that don't have private bathrooms for every child. They don't care about having a toilet with a self-closing lid. They just want a functioning bathroom. They don't care if the kitchen cabinets and drawers close by themselves. They just want a kitchen so they can cook some food. They don't want welfare. They just want to fare well. But just because they may not want everything that we want does not mean that they don't need the same things we need. As we move forward through these challenging times, we find ourselves living in a paradox. According to an article published in the Washington Post in April, almost 20% of food processing workers and more than 36% of agriculture workers are undocumented. The article goes on to point out that the healthcare industry, construction companies, and the service industry also rely heavily on migrants. Included in this article is a quote from a Wisconsin dairy farmer. Quote, "Our industry doesn't exist without immigration labor. 80% of the milk in Wisconsin is harvested by immigrants. If you took the immigrants away, over half of the farms would go out of business, which many are already doing." And that is the paradox. These workers are essential for all, but at the same time, unwanted by many. So, no, Mrs. So-called Nazarene Christian, these refugees aren't coming here to kill us. And even though you aren't listening, I have this to say to you. You should be ashamed of yourself for spreading such vile. Do you even hear your own voice? Does your Savior hear your voice? If so, you need to be worried. You need to be very worried. We cannot undo the past, but if we learn from our failed policies, if we try to solve for the causes rather than the effects, we might have better results. This means dealing with human migration as a humanitarian issue, recognizing the failures of bad policies that contribute to it, and promoting stability in regions that spawn it. This means recognizing that sometimes these migrant strangers among us are more often refugees and not rapists and murderers. This means welcoming the least of them with the best of us. I'm sure we all know that not everybody embraces the same principles as we do, and that we ourselves sometimes fall short in our efforts to live up to them. Our first principle calls us to covenant to affirm and promote the worth and dignity of every person. It is a noble calling, and we all do our best. But let's face it, there are many in our nation, in the world, who disagree and use their voice and their fists to prove it. But it's in our second and sixth principles where we find more convincing language to promote a humanitarian approach to human migration, with compassion in human relations, with equity and justice, and with the goal of world community. Yet, once again, there are many in our country who disagree. And they are strong-minded, they go to church on Sundays, they stick together, and they vote. But we are strong-minded. We go to church on Sundays, well, at least once in a while. We stick together, and we vote, too. True, we aren't as numerous. But recall this quote from Margaret Mead. "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, It's the only thing that ever has. So, as we confer neighborhood by believing in and living out all of our principles, as we encourage our neighbors to listen to themselves, and we do the same, as we raise our voice when we need to and hush ourselves when it's best, may we always use our words, may we always use our voice, and may we always use our strength to nurture the beauty of humanity and not the beast. Before we extinguish the chalice with the words that are in your order of service, I would like to point out that at the bottom of the order of service is a link if you would like to go to that and watch some fireworks with some music in the background. My closing words, then, come from Chapter 81 of the Tao Te Ching, translated by Stephen Mitchell. While originally written in Chinese with a voice appealing to Eastern sentiments, Mitchell's translation provides a voice more suited to the Western ear. When he uses the word master, he does not mean someone who lords over you. Instead, it means that during our lifelong journey to master the art of life. He alters the words, the use of pronouns, using he, his, and him in one chapter, and then in the next chapter he uses she and her. Once again, Chapter 81, the last chapter of the Tao Te Ching. True words aren't eloquent. Eloquent words aren't true. Wise men don't need to prove their point. Men who need to prove their point aren't wise. The master has no possessions. The more he does for others, the happier he is. The more he gives to others, the wealthier he is. So, as I extinguish the chalice, please recite aloud the words that are in your order of service. And then that concludes the service. Thank you.